Good afternoon. I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals. We've got two cases to be argued this afternoon, and I understand that the attorneys have all checked in for both cases. We'll do a panel change between the two cases, so we'll take a short recess between them. But we'll start with the CLC roofing case, and before we begin that, I want to introduce the panel for this case. And to my right is Justice Lee Gabriel. To my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. Will the clerk please call the case?
Court will now call CLC Roofing Incorporated versus E.G. Meisner and Mark Thompson. May it please the court, Ms. Catherine Schilling will argue for the appellant and cross appellee. Ms. Caitlin Hubbard will argue for the appellee, Mark Thompson. Mr. David F. Johnson will argue for the appellee, cross appellant, E.G. Meisner.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, Catherine Schilling on behalf of CLC Roofing. I'm going to put my pen down because I've been told sometimes I click it when I speak. This case is really a simple case that has gotten muddied and convoluted. It's simple except for the damages. Damages issue has been a problem, and I want to start out by informing the court that we are going to concede the damages issues to the extent of agreeing with the trial court's judgment of the 188, 202.12 for actual damages, which includes the offset and credit, as well as the reduction in punitive damage. So what I would like to do today is to focus my argument more on the liability issues and some of the attendant issues relating thereto. When I say this is a simple case, we have and I know that you've read the briefs, but we have what is known as a bulk buy program, where Mr. Cross bought bulk shingles for roofing, and he wanted to get better rates, and he went and got a line of credit, worked a deal with JEH to enter into a bulk buy program. No one disputes that bulk buy program, what it was. It was a method. He went and got his line of credit. He would use that line of credit to buy shingles in bulk. JEH was supposed to purchase them with Mr. Cross's money, or CLC Roofing's money, store them and segregate them at its Mansfield warehouse. That is evidenced by the landlord's release, which is attached to our brief. That was a requirement of CLC Roofing's bank to make sure that they had a first priority security lien on the goods, materials purchased by CLC Roofing under that bulk buy program.
I get that there was a breach of contract here, but, or at least arguably a breach of contract here. And what I have trouble with is figuring out how there's a fraud.
Okay.
So step me through how something morphs from just a breach of contract into a fraud.
Do that by giving an analogy. This case is similar to a situation, again, putting it simple form. Someone gives me money to go pay their utilities, and I take that money and I go pay my mortgage because I'm behind on my mortgage and I'll make it up later. But I don't, and the first time that person who entrusted me with their money finds out about it is when the utilities are cut off.
Okay, taking that example, taking your example you just gave, what is the evidence that the appellants in this case went and used the monies inappropriately? Because I know we do from the company and the former president, but what is it about these two individuals that we have in this case?
Mr. Helzer was the COO, Chief Operating Officer. Testimony was undisputed that he ran the day-to-day operations and made decisions regarding The day-to-day operations, along with Mr. Rayback, made financial decisions.
Is there any testimony or evidence that he knew that the money was being used inappropriately?
Absolutely. Mr. Helzer himself testified. He was asked, what did you do with the monies CLC Roofing gave you? Let's just focus on the June 2012 bulk buy. What did you do with those? Put them in the operating account. What's the operating account? Well, I pay salaries, phone bills, light bills.
Well, but there's nothing other than your argument about the landlord's release. There's no evidence that E.G. Helzer had any conversations or had anything to do with the June 2012 bulk buy, had any relationship with CLC concerning that, was there?
No, that's not true. There's evidence in our brief cited in the record that Mr. Helzer, Mark Thompson, the sales guy, would get together with Mr. Cross of CLC and would negotiate the terms of each bulk buy, because they did vary.
Yeah, but that's not evidence of any kind of fraud or anything being done inappropriately. That's a business relationship. A salesman dealing with a customer.
Except for the fact that they were involved, it was a bulk buy. The June 2012 was a bulk buy. They knew because of the agreement of their terms. And nobody disputes this. It's undisputed that based on landlord's release, what the agreement was. The agreement was
I think it is disputed. You say they have to go buy from a third-party vendor. You say that they can't buy or draw on JEH's current inventory. They say they could, and therefore there was nothing inappropriate about putting that money in the general fund and using it on your bills. So that is disputed, is it not?
That's their argument. Our argument is the agreement required them to purchase. Otherwise, the bank has no security interest. If they had done per the agreement, per the landlord's release, then when this case went to bankruptcy, those shingles, those materials, would have been segregated and therefore not part of the bankruptcy estate. The reason why they were part of the bankruptcy estate is because Helzer never took the money and purchased those shingles. They said, well, we'll just put it in the kitty and we'll just draw whenever you make an order. But that wasn't the agreement. That was never the understanding of the bulk buy. The whole point of the landlord's release was a security interest. They took those monies to hold in trust for CLC Roofing. They had an obligation to do with those monies what they represented they would do. And they didn't do it. And they knew they didn't do it. And Thompson knew they didn't do it because he testified, what's the first thing you do when Chad calls up and places an order under his bulk buy? Well, I call around and see if we've got inventory on the ground. I've got a lot of people I can call and do that. He wouldn't have to make that call if they had actually purchased the products, segregated them on the books of JEH. There would have been no bankruptcy. We wouldn't be here. If they had performed and not misrepresented how they were handling the money, then we wouldn't be here. And it wouldn't have been part of the bankruptcy estate, and CLC would have got back.
Okay, some of the affirmative misrepresentations other than the landlord's release, affirmative misrepresentations that were relied upon as evidence of fraud that they mishandled the money. Can you point to anything other than the landlord's release?
The landlord's release and the conversations, the testimony shows that that's the understanding between Thompson, Helzer, and CLC, Chad Cross, is this is how the bulk buy was going to be done. And it was never, ever performed according to that agreement. In fact, they never intended to perform it. They immediately put it in the operating account. They never purchased up front. When he handed them that $300-some thousand, they didn't go purchase anything. They just said, we'll put it in our operating account and we'll purchase it when we get to, i.e. the utilities versus my mortgage.
But there's no problem. An explicit representation that they would go and buy from a third-party vendor the shingles.
It doesn't matter where they buy. The key is they were required to purchase.
Well, can't they purchase from JEH? Why can't CLC
purchase? Because JEH didn't own it. Thus, the prime source return. That's why it got returned. They didn't own it. They didn't pay their bills. So JEH didn't own it. What they were doing is prime source had a first lien. The bankruptcy court got those materials. So Mr. Cross's, CLC's, first lien right on the security for the materials that he paid for and they agreed to purchase was never perfected because they didn't handle his money right. They went and used it to pay their own operating bills. So those products were never purchased, and the details of the bulk buy required them to purchase it at the time the invoice was generated, and CLC paid that money. Supposed to go out and purchase it, segregate it, store it.
So every time someone fails to perform under a contract, their failure, and it causes some kind of problem down the road, that is a fraud.
I'm sorry, could you repeat?
So every time someone fails to perform under a contract, their failure to perform, if it causes some kind of harm, is a fraud.
No. Under Formosa Plastics, the Jim Walter Homes, you know the history of this. You can, it can sound in contract, but it can also sound in tort. They had a contract to perform, but what they did is they took the money without any intention, knowingly misrepresenting what they were going to do with that money. That's not a breach of contract.
Where's the proof of that statement? That's what I want to know. Show me in the record of the trial. What you just said, where's the proof that they took the money intentionally, knowing that they were not going to use it for what it was promised for? These two individuals that we had before us. I'm not talking about the company, nor am I talking about President Helzer. I'm talking about the two individuals that we had before us.
Mr. Helzer testified.
We know he testified that they put the money in the general account.
And he testified that there was no problem as long as they provided CLC with shingles whenever they ordered it. Well, that's true. And that's what led him to not question it. You know, they've got some mitigation issues. There's no mitigation. They led him to believe. They provided false inventory reports, leading him to believe, this is what we've purchased for you. Those were false. Testimony at trial shows that.
I didn't see any testimony in my search of the record where anybody knew that those inventory sheets were false.
I can't point to that right now. I'd be happy to submit a letter brief following oral argument to point those issues on the record. But those inventory reports were not accurate, and there is testimony to that effect.
Well, not accurate is one thing. Intentionally false is another.
Well, they were representing that they had these materials.
Again, intentionally false. As
yes.
I recall the testimony from the lady who prepared the inventory sheets, she just relied upon what was in the computer and didn't go out and physically look to see if the inventory was there.
But
in my mind, that was a mistake, not an intentionally false statement.
You know, this is, I'm glad you bring that up, because this is really very much akin to the Alexander versus Kent case that we cite in our brief. It's out of this court. Analogous situation where somebody took money for one purpose. It was a construction case, and the contractor was to submit monthly payment applications to get paid. Part of that was representation that we've paid all the subs. Well, guess what? As sometimes happens, some of the subs weren't paid. They didn't find out about it until a problem arose. Here, the bankruptcy. Because they had represented and covered it up and issued, everything was rock and rolling just fine until the subs started complaining. And the employee in that case said, well, you know, I was acting in my capacity as a officer of the company or whatever, I can't be held liable. And the court squarely said, no. It's well settled that an employee who acts and directs in improper conduct can be held personally liable. So he lost that argument. He said, well, I just signed the things. I didn't really verify whether they were accurate. Doesn't matter. This court said they were false. They relied on those representations, and they suffered injury as a result. And that's exactly what happened in this case. If they had, they talk about partial performance. There was never partial performance. What they did is they gave the impression that these shingles, these bulk buy, these materials that they purchased on June 12, or in June 2012, they gave the appearance that they were on the ground at Mansfield, what they were supposed to be, because they would fulfill any orders that that Mr. Cross requested. They would provide inventory reports showing the bulk buy and drawing down, even though, undisputed, that $300,000 worth of material was never actually purchased by JEH when it received those monies. It was never segregated. They were borrowing Peter to pay Paul, which resulted in the injuries that if they had done it right, CLC, we wouldn't be here. CLC would have had a first lien security interest. Bankruptcy court would have turned it over to him. They would have been, they basically held it in constructive trust. When you take someone's money and you say, I'm going to do this with it, you can't go do something else with it. That's really what this case is about.
Constructive trust is different than fraud.
Pardon?
Constructive trust is different than fraud.
Well, I use that term because as an illustration of they took money to use for one purpose. And we use the term, you know, in trust. They took it to do one thing, and they did something else with it. Pure and simple. And that's the fraud. And they knew it. Helzer knew it from the get-go. Mark Thompson says, well, when I got the bulk buys, I went and tried to find out if we have it in inventory. I have to go look. You wouldn't have to look if it's over there as they represent it in the inventory reports and as they represent it at the beginning of the bulk buy program.
That brings up another question. Is it even relevant what Mark Thompson knew afterwards? Wouldn't what be proper and relevant as far as Mr. Thompson's representations or omissions be what he knew as of June 28th?
Mr. Thompson knew about the landlord's release. He knew about the bulk buy program. He's the one that brought that program to E.G. Helzer. He knew that CLC was getting a line of credit and was going to buy these mass bulk purchases that they were going to
store. I don't doubt he didn't know. He knew all of that.
Yeah.
I'm saying that at a certain point you're saying that he learned that inventory wasn't on hand.
He knew that wasn't true by his statement. At least that's some evidence.
He knew it was true on June 28th?
That was the last bulk buy. He testified that any time Mr. Cross called to pull product from any of his bulk buys, including the June 12th, he would call and check and see if they had it in inventory. The jury was free to conclude from that testimony alone that he knew the money was not being used as represented to buy the materials. There would be no need to go check to see if it was in inventory because it should have been in inventory.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please the court, Ms. Schilling. I'm David Johnson on behalf of E.G. Helzer. I only have 10 minutes. I'm allocating 5 minutes to Mr. Thompson's counsel. The court's questioning has illuminated some of my main arguments, and that is the trial court's judgment in this case is dangerous precedent. We have a company that enters into a contract, then performs that contract for a portion of time, then breaches it. Are the employees that touch or are involved in that contract then liable for fraud because the terms of the contract weren't performed at some point, or because they didn't affirmatively go out and tell the other side, my boss is breaching the contract? This is a kind of a novel holding in Texas law, and it's contrary to Texas law, and it's contrary to the Restatement 551, which is where this whole duty to disclose outside of a confidential relationship originates. So, because there's no evidence of active fraud or fraud by nondisclosure, E.G. Helzer asked this court to reverse and render for him in this case. Getting to the active fraud, and the court's already noted that this wasn't just a freewheeling, you know, did they commit fraud, what were the damages? This is a very specific jury questions. Was the fraud related to the June 28th, 2012 bulk buy agreement? Transaction. And there were two prior bulk buys that were consummated, that were fully performed, and that they didn't complain about, and that's not a part of this case. This case is solely about the last one. And where, you know, 12,000 bundles of shingles were purchased in a bulk buy, there's no written agreement about what the terms were. It was an oral agreement. There was a landlord's release document that the buyer asked that the seller, JEH, sign to give the buyer's lender some comfort that they would be able to go and foreclose on that property later. There's nothing in that landlord's release that is false. It doesn't require what CLC has represented to this court that it requires. They're saying that that required us to go out and use the funds solely to purchase shingles from a third party and bring them in and keep them on our yard. Every time we couldn't sell them our own shingles. And that's not, I mean, you can read it over and over as I have, and it doesn't require that. All it requires is that we do segregate shingles that they have purchased. And the testimony in this case is that that was done. The testimony is that it was taken out of inventory, it was placed on a separate spreadsheet and not in the inventory anymore, and it was segregated in the yard, and that it was spray painted with a customer's name on it.
And let me ask you something, Mr. Johnson. Assuming that all of that is true, and we come down to a fight over what the landlord's release said, isn't that really just a breach of contract case, not fraud?
Yes, sir, it is. And because you have to have, there has to be intent not to perform at the time. There's no evidence that JEH or my client, E.G. Helzer, had any intent not to perform that promise at the time it was signed. And secondly, partial performance can negate as a matter of law the fact that I didn't intend to perform my promise. If I did my promise for several months, then that negates the fact that I didn't intend to do my promise. And we have cases and cases that we've cited to the court for that proposition. So, I could read the landlord's release to you, but this court can certainly read it on your own, and you can determine that it doesn't require us to buy singles from a third party, which it makes no sense. What counsel's didn't mention is that on each one of these bulk buy transactions, the uncontested evidence was that we had more than sufficient inventory of our own to sell to them. So it wasn't like we were short. We had the inventory in our yard that we could move and use for their purposes. So the issue is at some point thereafter, whenever Jim Helzer, a different party, decides to send their product back to his vendor, and there was some discussion by opposing counsel as to whether that was owned by who owned it. There's no evidence in the record. There was no evidence of what the agreement between Prime Source and JEH was. There's no evidence as to who owned JEH's inventory. The only evidence is that JEH had inventory. They moved it over there for CLC. At some point, 6 months later, Jim Helzer says, apparently I owe money to my vendor. I'm going to take their product and give it to my vendor. That wasn't my client's decision. The evidence in this record is completely clear. My client did not make that decision. And there's no evidence that he was involved in that decision other than the fact that he just knew that it happened. So, and what's interesting is that the trial court agreed that my client wasn't responsible for active fraud. And it's a little confusing why he went ahead and gave him a charge submission on it. But at the fifth reporter's record, page 160, talking about directed verdict motions, the trial court says the evidence shows that E.G. Helzer made some representations at the outset, but the evidence establishes that those representations were not false at the time they were made. But there's some evidence that they subsequently became false, and therefore there is some evidence that E.G. Helzer had a duty to correct what was then becoming a misrepresentation by omitting information with respect to the last invoice. So I think what the court was doing was saying, well, since I'm going to submit it anyway, I want to go ahead and give you both questions, and I'll clean it up after trial. After trial, he did clean up a lot of it, but he cleaned up all of it for Mr. Thompson, but he still felt like, well, because you knew you said they were going to segregate this shingles in June of 2012, you knew in December of 2012 that representation was false, you should have told them in December or January or February or March that your previous statement was untrue. And I think that's what the trial judge was going on in affirming the fraud finding against my client, was on the duty to disclose. And so that gets into my second point. And, you know, the problem with that is, once again, Restatement 551 clearly says that this section expressly limits the expanded duty of disclosure to only before the transaction is consummated. And Texas law that has addressed this issue is similarly clear. You know, 99% of the time, the fraud by non-disclosure claim, you know, deals with an apartment complex or whatever it is. And you told me that there was no problems with the police coming out there. And then before the deal was done, you find out, oh, well, actually, there were police out there a whole bunch. And you didn't disclose that fact to me before the deal was done. That's 99% of the time these things come up. This is a little bit different case. This is I didn't know I was making a partial statement or a untrue statement, because 6 months later, after the deal is done, my employer breaches the contract. Restatement says there's no duty to disclose that subsequent new revelation. But it also attaches really all the elements of a fraud by non-disclosure claim. There's also the element of, do I have a duty to, I don't have a duty, I failed to disclose a material fact within the knowledge of that party. Well, when is the knowledge relevant? It's before the transaction, before June 28th. But it's not in my knowledge. Do I intend for you to induce do I intend to induce you to enter into that transaction by failing to disclose it? Well, no, I don't, because it happened 6 months later. Did you rely on it? No. Did you have any damages because of it? No. So the end result is the entire fraud by non-disclosure claim falls away because of the timing element set forth in 551. And more importantly, from a public policy standpoint, this puts employees in a very tenable position. I owe fiduciary duties. Supreme Court has held I owe fiduciary duties to my employer. I have fiduciary duties of loyalty, of confidentiality. So now am I supposed to disregard those duties to my employer and go tell every single party that my employer is breaching a contract with, oh, my employer is breaching your contract, so they can go do something about it? I don't think that's where we want to go. That's not fair to put employees in that sort of a conflict situation. So respectfully, Your Honors, we would ask that this court reverse and render judgment for Mr. Helzer. We've also briefed some serious charge errors, and would ask that if the court does not reverse and render, the court reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Caitlin Hubbard, and I represent Appellee Mark Thompson, the salesman, in this transaction. Now, I want to clarify from the get-go that the only jury finding against Mr. Thompson was fraud by non-disclosure. So we are not talking about an affirmative misrepresentation with respect to him. And the trial court correctly set aside that jury finding because no legally sufficient evidence supported it. And I want to clarify on this point that the evidence in this case is necessarily defendant-specific. Because whether that duty exists depends on what the defendant knew and when they knew it, as you've heard today, it's going to vary. So whatever the evidence may be as to Mr. Helzer, it is not going to be relevant to Mr. Thompson. And certainly with respect to Mr. Thompson, there is simply no legally sufficient evidence that he owed a duty, that he breached it, or that CLC relied to its detriment. And I won't rehash the issues today with respect to the restatement, Section 551, but that is our argument, that these expanded duties, which we acknowledge this court has adopted, come directly from the restatement second of torts. And you can't piecemeal that. You either take it all or nothing. And as Mr. Johnson has pointed out, and as Justice Sutter, if you have pointed out, it's simply not wise to piecemeal the restatement in that fashion. We're going to have issues with put our Texas employees in untenable positions, and it's really hard to find where a breach of contract starts and a fraud claim ends. And for those reasons, we don't think that this court should be the first court to take that step.
Let me ask you a question with regards to the landlord's release and your client. I recall testimony on the record that he said that he did not receive, read, or agree to that terms of that release. Is there any other evidence in the record that he knew the terms of the landlord's release, and if so, that he knew CLC's beliefs that they were being followed?
No, Justice Pittman. The only evidence in the record, the sole evidence in the record in that regard, is that he was, quote, aware of the landlord release. It doesn't say when he became aware. It doesn't say the extent of that awareness. There's nothing in the record that says that he understood the terms of that. And for that, I can point you directly to the fourth volume of the reporter's record, page 19. Additionally, it was Mr. Helzer that considered the specifics of it, along with Mr. Rabick, and they signed. And Mr. Helzer signed the agreement, not Mark Thompson. And that is for reporter's record 102 and 106. More than that, CLC, Mr. Cross of CLC, could not even recall if he had emailed that landlord's agreement to Mr. Thompson. That is for reporter's record, page 24. And putting even that aside and turning to the facts, and I'll start in this regard by pointing out that we raised all of these arguments, and in CLC's reply, they addressed only one page to this fraud by non-disclosure and Section 551 issue. And in that, it appears that they might be conceding it because they abandoned the litany of non-disclosures that they set forth in their opening brief, and they focus on only one, and that is whether Mark Thompson knew prior to the June 28, 2012 transaction, that JEH was not actually purchasing the materials.
And there's any evidence of that?
An inference is what they call it.
What's
we
the
would
inference?
Answer no. The inference
what's the inference?
The inference that they point to, Your Honor, is that each time Mr. Cross would call or CLC would call and place an order, Mr. Thompson would call JEH and say, hey, do we have sufficient material on hand? That is the beginning and end of it. And under the equal inference rule, that is no evidence at all. In fact, it's equally plausible that he was calling JEH to say, hey, how much of the bulk buy has CLC already depleted? Or CLC also placed individual orders. Perhaps he was calling for that. More than anything, it actually supports the entire record in this case that Mr. Thompson was an outside salesman, that he had no involvement in the order fulfillment processes, that he did not know the accounting or back office, and in fact, the inventory levels were, as Mr. Johnson pointed out, completely sufficient to satisfy the bulk buys through August 2012. So Mr. Thompson wasn't even on notice that they did not have these materials on site, and he certainly didn't know that they had not been paid for. Well, for all of those reasons, as well as the litany of other reasons in our brief of why the trial court's judgment was correct and should be affirmed, we respect that this court, we respectfully request that this court affirm it. And at one more point with respect to the damages concession, to the extent Your Honors get there, I'm not quite sure what to do with that because we've briefed and there was ambiguity in the damages, certainly in the trial court, even in the briefing, and the over $200,000 number that we just heard, we don't believe supported. It appears that perhaps CLC is including this disputed interest figure, which we don't think the evidence is legally sufficient to support, nor that this court can render for. Thank you.
Real briefly, Your Honor. I keep hearing the whether we're required to purchase it from a third party. Again, it was just required to be purchased. If that had been done, we wouldn't be here. And yes, the June 2012 is the only bulk buy issue because for a long time, the process worked. They were able to go pull inventory and hopefully pay their suppliers. But this fell apart when JEH couldn't pay its suppliers and it had never actually purchased materials on behalf of CLC. That's when the game fell apart and they got caught. That's what happens. Going back to the utilities versus mortgage, if somebody gives me money and I continue paying the utilities for 2 or 3 months, they're never going to know it. But at some point, they're going to find it out, and they're going to find they gave me money to use for one thing, and I used it for something different. That's pure and simple what this case is about. And the evidence does show that Thompson was the one responsible for tracking and fulfilling and managing CLC's bulk buy orders once they were placed. That's
so
part of his job.
In your argument, Mr. Thompson should be held liable for fraud because he didn't go out and check the inventory every single time to make sure it was purchased?
He knew it hadn't been purchased.
Where's the evidence of that?
His statement that what was the first thing he'd do? I'd call up and see if we had it in inventory. He's
I'm not sure how you get there.
Because he's responsible for tracking. He has access to the inventory.
So again, his duty would have been to have went out on the site and make sure the inventory was there. That's why you're alleging he engaged in fraudulent activity?
What I'm saying is it's his duty to know how many bundles of shingles were bought with $300,000. It's his duty, because Chad placed the orders through him, to know how many of those were drawn down. It's a simple math. 300 bundles of shingles less.
Why is it his duty to know how much was drawn down? If he's just a salesman, they're used.
Because
to
he's business. Charged, the evidence shows he was charged with managing CLC's account. That's his duty as a salesman. He doesn't just sell it and throw up his hands. His job is to service it, sales and service.
Is the seller or purchaser for Lockheed responsible for going out and counting each and every airplane that he's been told that are in the inventory to be sold?
No, but if he sells it, he can be held liable if, in fact, they took the money and bought a trip around the world.
If he intentionally made a misrepresentation, and I'm not seeing that. Can you help me? I'm looking for the fraud here. I'm not talking about a breach of contract.
Right. Because Thompson knew what the bulk buy program was supposed to be. And there's some evidence in the record from which the jury could conclude, and did conclude, that if he had to go check inventory to see if it was on the ground, that he, there's some evidence that the jury could say, well, he knew they weren't buying those shingles.
Well, if he had to go check, that tells me he didn't know. You don't go check something you know. If you know it's not there, then you don't have to go check. But to pick up the phone and say, do we have it, indicates to me he doesn't know one way or the other.
My point is, if they had handled as represented, he wouldn't have to check. It would be there. You wouldn't have to make a call. All you have to do is look at the inventory and go, well, you ordered 300 shingles, you've taken 100. Yeah, you got 200 on there. I'll get you 75 bundles of shingles. That's it. It's that simple. You wouldn't have to make that call based if the account, if it had been purchased and the account had been handled appropriately.
But if you know they weren't buying it the way you say they should have,
then you would have,
you don't have to make a call because you know it's not there.
Well, no, that's why he called and said, I got to check if we've got them in inventory, because he knew they were pulling them from their, from JEH's inventory, which, by the way, hadn't all been paid for, or it wouldn't have been returned. They obviously weren't paying their bills, so they didn't take CLC's money to buy CLC shingles, and they didn't take CLC's money to pay for shingles that it could draw from. So, they can use the CLC's money and buy from their own inventory, but they didn't even do that. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. If they had truly paid for the CLC shingles that CLC ordered, there wouldn't be a problem, because those would be transferred, held exclusively for CLC, and not part of their generic inventory that they hadn't paid for.
And again, that sounds like a breach of contract.
Not when you know from...
I need some fraudulent activity. You're asking that two employees of a company that weren't a party to the contract be held liable. So we have to have the elements of fraud. So I need to see the evidence of that. You keep saying they. What's the evidence that these two individuals that are before the court today?
Because they knew what they represented and what the program was supposed to be, and they knew it wasn't never complied with. That wasn't how they were operating it. And Mr. Rayback even testified he had concerns how it was being handled, because it wasn't being handled properly. You can't take someone's money and agree to hold it for one thing and go spend it on something else. It'll work for a while till you get caught. And that's what happened. And it didn't happen. They juggled really well until the June 2012, and then it caught up with them. They were using the money, Mr.'s testimony, Mr. Helzer used the money to pay himself exorbitant
salaries. Where is the evidence that they knew from the get-go that's how they were going to run it? And so it was a misrepresentation.
Helzer's testimony that he always took the money and put it in an operating account to pay other bills. And they don't dispute. They do not. There's nowhere in the record where they dispute that they didn't actually purchase it. They just say, well, there's nothing wrong with us going in our inventory and pulling it. Well, there wasn't until you got caught and there was no more inventory to pull from and our guy lost, you know, $200,000. That's a problem. That's fraud. But they covered that up continually and made it appear as though the bulk buy program was working, but it wasn't. They never did it from the get-go. They handled it wrong from the out of the gate,
and
they knew it.
Thank you.
Counselors,
we appreciate your argument. It's been helpful. We've got another argument next, and you're free to stay if you'd like, but you're also free to go.